A little of the old optimism began to creep back. The Endurance might just make it. Three times the ship had come under attack from the ice, and always the pressure had been worse than the time before. But each time, the Endurance had fought back, and she had won. As the early days of October passed, the ice showed definite signs of opening. Temperatures, too, began to rise. On October the 10th, the thermometer climbed to 9.8 degrees above zero. The floe, which had been jammed under the ship's starboard side since July, broke free on October the 14th, and the Endurance lay in a small pool of open water, truly afloat for the first time since she was beset 9 months before. The officers and scientists could now move back into the wardroom in the deckhouse. The partitions and the Ritz were taken down, and the area was reconverted into a hold for stores. Shackleton decided on October the 16th that the opening tendency of the pack justified getting up steam on the chance that they could force a way through. All hands were put to pumping up the boilers with water. This exhausting 3.5-hour job was hardly finished when a serious leak was discovered in one of the fittings, and the boilers had to be pumped out again so the engineers could make repairs. By the time the job was completed, it was too late to get underway. Early the next afternoon, a lead of open water appeared ahead of the ship. There wasn't time to get up steam, so the men set all sails, trying to force her into the crack. She wouldn't budge. October 18th dawned a misty, snowing morning. The lead ahead had disappeared, and the ice was a little closer. Throughout the day, the ship felt little nips of pressure, but nothing serious. Then, at 4:45 p.m., the floes on either side of the Endurance closed in against her and kept on closing. Every man on board stiffened, as if he himself had been touched. Several raced up the ladders onto deck. In the next instant, the deck seemed to slide away from beneath their feet as the ship rolled suddenly over to port. A second's pause, then everything movable let go with a rush. Wood, kennels, ropes, sledges, stores, dogs, and men cascaded across the deck. James was caught under two boxes of winter clothing, onto which a pile of dogs descended in whining, howling confusion. Clouds of steam rose from the galley and the wardroom, where pots of water were upset onto the fires. In the space of 5 seconds, the Endurance was heeled over 20 degrees to port, and she continued to fall off. Worsley rushed to the lee rail and watched as plank after plank disappeared under the ice. Greenstreet stood nearby, ready to jump. The floe to starboard had got a grip on the bulge of her hull and was simply rolling her over. At 30 degrees to port, she slowed, then stopped, with her bulwarks resting on the ice and the lifeboats nearly touching. Said Worsley, "She seemed to say to the grinding, hungry pack, 'You may smash me, but I'm damned if I'll go over another inch for you. I'll see you melting in hell first.'" The moment the Endurance came to rest, Shackleton ordered the fires extinguished. Then everyone went systematically about the job of restoring order. They lashed down everything that was loose and nailed small strips of wood to the deck to give the dogs a foothold. About 7 o'clock, the work on deck was finished, and the men went below. To behold a scene in which every hanging article looked as if it were caught in a high wind. Curtains, pictures, clothing, and cooking utensils all hung out from the starboard bulkhead. Green managed to prepare a supper, while the rest of the crew nailed more battens to the decks below. The meal was eaten, with most of them sitting on the deck, one above another, holding their plates in their laps.
"We look like we're sitting in a grandstand," James remarked.
About 8 o'clock, the floes under the Endurance drew apart, and the ship quickly righted herself. The crew was sent to chopping away the ice from around the rudder. They finished about 10 p.m. A ration of grog was issued, and they began pumping up the boilers again. At 1 o'clock in the morning, all hands except the watch turned in, bone-tired. October 19th was a day free from pressure, and there was very little activity of any sort. A killer whale surfaced in the lane of open water alongside the ship and cruised with graceful arrogance up and down for a time. The last barometer reading of the day was 28.96, the lowest since the disastrous blizzard in July. Again, on October the 20th, there was little change in the pack. Nevertheless, everything was made ready to get underway whenever an opening appeared. The engines were turned over slowly and found to be in good order. Regular four-hour sea-watches were set. The 21st and the 22nd, similarly, were days of watchful waiting. The only change in the pack was that it appeared to close slightly. The temperature dropped from 10 above zero to minus 14 degrees. Late on the 22nd, the wind swung around 180 degrees from southwest to northeast. McNeish wrote in his diary that night, "Very quiet, but there looks as if there was going to be a bit of pressure." Chapter 8. It was slow to arrive. October the 23rd dragged by uneventfully, except that the pack was working somewhat under the influence of the northeast wind. When at 6:45 p.m. on October the 24th the pressure did arrive, it wasted no time. There had been pressure in the past, but nothing like this. It moved through the pack like a sluggish shockwave, making the entire surface of the ice into a chaos of churning, tumbling destruction. Macklin watched it briefly, then turned away in disbelief. "The whole sensation," he recorded, "was of something colossal, of something in nature too big to grasp." Effortlessly, the ice jostled and badgered the ship until she was pinned up against two floes fore and aft on the starboard side, and kneed in the center on the other. A heavy mass of ice ground across her stern, tearing the sternpost partly away from the starboard planking. Water poured in. McNeish was sent to check and reported back that it was rising rapidly in the forward hold. Rickinson said the same of the engine room. The small portable Downton pump was rigged and steam was raised to operate the engine room bilge pumps. They were going by 8 p.m., but they failed to hold the water in check. All hands that could be spared were put on the primary hand pumps alongside the mainmast, but after several minutes of pumping, no water had come up. The intakes were obviously frozen. Worsley took Hudson and Greenstreet with him down into the bunkers. Working in almost total darkness and icy cold, they dug and squirmed their way down to the keel, through the wet, slimy coal into which the blubber from 60 seals had been dumped. The sounds of the tormented ship were deafeningly close. They poured bucket after bucket of boiling water into the frozen pipe. One of the men played the flame of a blowtorch on the stubborn fittings, while the other two pounded to loosen the clogged intakes. Finally, after an hour's work, the pumps broke loose. McNeish commenced to build a cofferdam 10 feet forward of the sternpost to seal off the after section of the ship and hold back the water. Between 15-minute spells of the pumps, some of the crew helped him cork the cofferdam with strips of torn blankets. Others went over the side with picks and ice saws to cut lines of weakness in the attacking flows. But as soon as each trench was dug, the ice crumpled along it, then bore in again. All night long they kept at it. 15 minutes on the pumps, 15 minutes off. Then over the side or back to the engine room. Though they were lean and hard after a year's tough work on the ship and on the sledges, 10 hours at the pumps and saws left even the strongest so exhausted they stumbled as they walked. At dawn, Shackleton ordered an hour's rest, and Green ladled out a bowl of porridge for each man. Then it was time to begin again. Toward mid-morning, Shackleton sent the dog drivers over the side to ready their teams and sledges in case of an immediate abandonment. Worsley took a party of seamen and cleared the boats for lowering. Most of them had stopped watching the pack in their struggle to save the ship. It had settled down some, but it was behaving strangely. Pressure ridges of a height never before seen rose between the flows, and the compression was fantastic, as if the pack had been shoved up against some solid barrier over the horizon. The men worked at the pumps and at building the cofferdam through the day and evening. About midnight, after 28 hours of ceaseless work, McNeish finished his job, at least as well as it could be finished. But it only slowed the flow of water, and the pumps had to be kept going. Each spell was an agony of effort, and when it was finished, the men staggered to their bunks or slumped into a corner.
It took perhaps 10 minutes for their exhausted muscles to loosen enough to let them sleep. Then, just as they dozed off, they were prodded up for their next turn. Toward evening, the pressure increased again. The flow along the port side ground against the ship, warping her along the entire length and wringing animal-like screams from her as the ice sought to break her back. At 9 p.m., Shackleton instructed Worsley to lower the boats and get all essential gear and provisions onto the floe to starboard, which seemed the least likely to break up. Late in the evening, the men on deck saw a band of about 10 emperor penguins. They waddled slowly up toward the ship, then stopped a short distance away. Emperors, singly or in pairs, were a common sight, but nobody had ever seen so large a group before. The penguins stood for a moment, watching the tortured ship, then raised their heads and uttered a series of weird, mournful, dirge-like cries. It was all the more eerie, because none of the men, not even the Antarctic veterans among them, had ever before heard penguins voice anything except the most elemental, croaking sorts of noises. The sailors stopped what they were doing, and old Tom MacLeod turned to Macklin. "Do you hear that?" he asked. "Will none of us get back to our homes again?" Macklin noticed Shackleton bite his lip. About midnight, the movement of the ice partly closed the wound in the stern, and the flow of water decreased. But still the hand pumps had to be manned to keep the water from gaining. They stayed at it all night, working with closed eyes like dead men attached to some evil contrivance which would not let them rest. It was no better at dawn or at noon. About 4 o'clock, the pressure reached new heights. The decks buckled and the beams broke. The stern was thrown upward 20 feet, and the rudder and sternpost were torn out of her. The water ran forward and froze, weighting her down in the bow, so that the ice climbed up her sides forward, inundating her under the sheer weight of it. Still they pumped. But at 5 o'clock, they knew it was time to give up. She was done, and nobody needed to tell them. Shackleton nodded to Wilde, and Wilde went forward along the quaking deck to see whether anybody was in the forecastle. He found Howe and Bakewell trying to sleep after a turn at the pumps. He put his head inside. "She's going, boys," he said. "I think it's time to get off." Part 2, Chapter 1. May the Lord help you to do your duty and guide you through all the dangers by land and sea. May you see the works of the Lord and all his wonders in the deep. These words were written on the flyleaf of a Bible given to the expedition by Queen Mother Alexandra of England. Shackleton carried the Bible in his hand as he left the Endurance and walked slowly across the ice toward the campsite. The others hardly noticed his arrival. They were busy crawling in and out of the tents, trying numbly to create some degree of comfort with what energy remained in them. Some arranged pieces of lumber to keep themselves off the snow-covered ice. Others spread pieces of canvas as ground covers. But there was not enough flooring for everybody, and several men had to lie directly on the bare snow. It made little difference. Sleep was all that mattered. And they slept, most of them embracing their nearest tentmates to keep them freezing. Shackleton did not even try to sleep. He paced continually around the floe. The pressure was still intense, and several times the campsite sustained a violent shock. The dark outline of the Endurance, 200 yards away, rose against the clear night sky. About 1 a.m., as Shackleton walked back and forth, there was a jolt. Then a thin, ribbon-like crack snaked across the floe among the tents. Almost immediately, it began to widen. Shackleton hurried from tent to tent, waking the exhausted sleepers. It required an hour's tricky work in the dark to transfer the camp to the larger half of the floe. Thereafter, all was quiet in the camp. Though just before dawn, there was a loud report from the Endurance. Her bowsprit and jib boom had broken and dropped onto the ice. For the rest of the night, Shackleton could hear the ghostly rhythm of the chain from the martingale boom being slowly dragged back and forth by the movement of the ship. When morning came, the weather was dull and overcast, but the temperature had climbed to 6 above 0. The men turned out stiff and cold from sleeping on the ice. It took a very long time for them to wake up.